her long death, seasons and years slipping by. I was lovingly caught, wanting to help, but wanting my life. And Gerald Hopkinson, standing by always. He was dear to me, the family friend who stepped forward after her diagnosis when I came home from Boulder to stay. Our parents were close, and he was my first date, first kiss. We were on and off during high school and college. Now we were both in our late 20s, neither having forged relationships. He was, still is, in banking. I never knew exactly what he did. Money markets, stock analysis, investments, often calming people on the phone. I lived in limbo. Jer lined up the care while I commuted and finished the semester, and then I was home from Boulder, my first full-time job teaching writing, for the duration. For relief, I taught one class a semester at the University of Miami. Mother came back from the melanoma surgery, but with a partially frozen left leg and her MS to boot, the struggle with her care was real and constant. Steroids puffed her body until she looked blown up and moony. The sheer labor became harder. I remember her anger flashing out, her swollen leg, and the small white feet, delicate as a porcelain doll's. I wanted her at home, not in some facility. She quite desperately wanted me with Jer, and she didn't hold back on saying that she wanted a grandchild. I never told her I was fated to be barren, as she would have called it. Jer and I just fell into each other again, and it seemed we were on track to marry and live forever in Coral Gables. Why, I wonder now, why I didn't get pregnant, prime fertility time, during that mini-marriage. As Mother failed, I began to have attacks of claustrophobia when I was at Jer's bungalow. Even sitting on the front porch with a lemonade after tennis, I'd feel a rising panic. Not my life. Not that I couldn't have practiced my art with him. He encouraged me. He just didn't meet me in my zone. And I couldn't cozy up to banking. But our circles overlapped. And in that gray zone of commonality, we had a shared history. Powerful juju. He liked to travel and cook and all that. But who doesn't? I was not going back to Boulder. Though I loved the town, it was not my place in the universe. Jer's slobbering boxer turned around and around before he flopped into a comfortable spot. That's what I did, too. When my mother died, the melanoma came raging back. I applied for a residency at a writer's retreat on the Tuscan coast. I got in. Jer knew without my telling him that I'd drawn a line, but I told him anyway. I was sorry and said so. Ever the gentleman, but he was ticked and made it clear that he wouldn't wait again. In Italy, weeks of healing and solitude and blissful writing. Most of the poems that got me the awards were conceived, there's that word, in a spare room overlooking the Tyrrhenian Sea. When I read them now, they seem dark blue with the mourning I carried. My mother's death brought back my father's, slammed from behind by a semi on the Miami Expressway. His vintage TR3 flew into the shallow bay, a trajectory I have rewound a million times. I was 31, both parents lost. I'd expected at the least another 20 years with them. With a couple of other writers at the retreat, I traveled on weekends. San Rocco is off the tourist loop. We happened upon it. The grace, the dignity, the encompassed time. I walked around town and imagined a long recuperation here, a big project, something entirely mine. After the writer's residency ended, I went home and packed up the house, leaving bare furnishings, putting too many plastic bins in a storage unit. What to do with thousands of family photos? My parents' college yearbooks, my grandmother's spode. Things. More things. A woman named Stacy Jackson and her two daughters rented the house, and within 6 months, she and Jer were a couple. How could he have moved in and taken over the rent checks? Creepy, I think. With my parents' money, I bought my house, Fonte delle Foglie, my heart's needle, outside San Rocco. Now I must thank Jer for inadvertently spurring me into a larger mental space. What I sensed was dead right. He and I lacked that mysterious quality I wanted, and without which a relationship is in peril. The poet Rilke's definition of intimacy, that two solitudes protect and greet and touch each other, never sounded right to me. Too bleak and otherworldly, spooky stuff. I had a better guide. From Robert Desaix's Corfu, I copied this quote. Intimacy is more, though, than just a burst of loving recognition between two people. But what is it? It is, perhaps, the experience we have sometimes, rarely, but we do have it, of growing transparent, softly penetrated to every corner by another's knowing gaze, and of his or her being pierced and known in turn by our inner eye. Guided by that and a million other things, I wrote furiously for a year. My mother, would she be pleased if she had lived? Probably she'd have worn out her hope by now. My mother was Idella Parkman Rain. If I have a girl, if I have a baby at all, maybe I'll name her Della Rain. Colin's last name, Davidson. Not bad. Della Rain Davidson. Della is lovely. Idella, no. New Leaf. Maybe Leaf would be a good name for a boy. Worked for Leif Erikson. Thinking of my mother's things in storage reminds me, a wheel of Colin's roll-on broke, and he went out to the barn to rummage around for another bag. He came across a suitcase belonging to Margaret that she left when she took off for Washington that last time. He opened it and brought in a wild dress. What else is in there? It's probably full of mildew. Looks like musty sweaters. I shook out the dress. I remember her at a New Year's party in this spangled thing. Off-shoulder crimson velvet, as liquid as wine pouring. She was smoking a big cigar, which she liked to do for effect. I watched. She didn't inhale. Line in notebook. Get rid of the junk she left. Clean out shed. Someone should wear that dress. But how intimate someone else's dress. Intimacy. She was off and on. She could wall herself off, too. Is it because I'm female that I proceed in my notebook from clean out shed to a new poem? Offspring. We lit the so-called fuse. Drops of semen, like glue we use to wallpaper the nursery. Smudge pot in the belly, ballooned and far-fetched. We were all once encased. Roly-poly skulls and crossbones. Fat little pirates, not knowing we were holding ourselves hostage. The brain plates slowly push toward the center, and the whirl of water in the funnel has nothing else to do but swirl down. What keeps us on this earth sometimes but blunder, or an off-secret, or an opposite to stillness, or a wandering from this past pasture to the next present pasture? Birth, an acquired taste, a lump sum inheritance, an oxytocic surprise visit by someone we weren't expecting to be so funny, so open and unsutured, so brilliantly nomadic and ragtag. For this, we have all come out to see you, lawless, see everything, to witness the biggest explosion, finally sprung free. This appeared whole cloth from words I listed in the back of my notebook. Nimble, anime, without law, funnel, imbuto, fontanelle, offspring, heruspex, font flow, offspring, ragtag, oxytocic, hastening childbirth, nomad, wandering in search of pasture. Words engender feelings, as much as feelings are expressed in words. Ever since lightning struck me, I've been writing poems non-stop. Where do they come from? Ether? Ichor? Or a poet is a heruspex. In Etruscan times, the one who divined meaning and future by the markings on the exposed liver of a sacrificed animal. Violetta brings my second cappuccino over just as Camille comes in the door. I am not going to interrupt. You look enthralled. She waves from the counter. I'll have to reread the poem later. Oh, join me. I'm leaving in a few. We're going to Florence for a couple of days. What are you up to this early? I think I'm picking up your habit. I just love the town as it starts all over. I see better when there are a few people out. I even like that teeny street sweeper truck that whooshes down the street. And the barista who delivers espresso to offices, he holds up a tray and walks along whistling. He's straight out of a Balthus painting. Where's he going, anyway? I think he's taking the mayor and his staff their wake-up shots. I love the electric street sweeper, too. The driver is a friend's son. He sometimes stops and gives me a hug. Where else is that going to happen? Camille talks about her frightening attempts to become a painter again at this late date, the Italian tutor she sees, and what she calls her discovery walks. I have eureka moments when I see an embedded column in a wall, or a stone coat of arms with carved deer antlers, or pears, or oak trees. Nothing subtle about those Medici ones, six balls. Or are they oranges? There's one street with the medieval overhang supported by flimsy-looking timbers. It's a stage set from Shakespeare. Not that he was medieval, but it looks like the Globe Theater. She adds, my husband and I used to love going to London. We always tried to see a Shakespeare production. Have you come across the two painters' restoration bottega down Vicolo della Notte? She has not. You'll love it. Matilda, she's the one with the wild copper hair, and her assistant, Serena, who is quite serene, are top art restorers. They've worked on many fresco cycles in Siena, Montefalco, and Arezzo, all over Tuscany. Their workshop is crammed with paintings that have been gouged or spilled on or are just obscured by layers of grime. They do what they must to bring them back. Okay, that sounds beyond fascinating. I'll find them. You have Archie with you. As she opens the door, I see him, his leash looped around an outdoor table leg. Oh, yes. Archie wants to become like the white terrier that's everywhere, a town dog. Full citizen rights to sleep in the middle of the street. I like Camille. Of the three, she's further back in herself, Friendly and quick, yes, but some quality of waiting? Is that it? She's attractive now and must have been a raving beauty once. If she had flowing silver hair instead of blonde, she would look like an oracle. A Roman second century sculptor would have rendered that face as goddess of the hunt. We'd look at her now in the Borghese Museum. I like thinking of marble Camille pulling back the string of her bow. Actually, she's paused in front of the ceramics shop, eyeing a pretty platter. I'm sure she's finding that when you start to cook in Italy, you need more platters than you ever considered. Then she walks on, talking to Archie, smiling at passers-by. No idea at all that within the hour her life will begin to change in a way she never considered. Happiness belongs to the self-sufficient, so said Aristotle. Now I have to hustle home and hope Colin is ready. We need to catch the 10 o'clock train. Discovery Walk. Camille especially loves the town's vicoli, the streets that climb or descend off the main street. Two donkeys barely could pass each other. Vicolo delle Notte falls sharply off the Via Gramsci, then twists behind buildings to face the valley. The bottega, which she's never passed before, is flooded with morning light. In the window, Matilda of the blazing curls and Serena, stark as a Quaker, stand before a commanding Madonna in blue holding out her skirts where a miniature town nestles under her protection. Serena aims a hairdryer at the side of the Madonna's head as though she's drying her hair. How clever! Apply quick heat to a repaired patch and then they can proceed. Camille, peering in the window, gets a smile and a wave from Matilda, who turns and shouts to another woman in the back. Camille hears a clatter, and then a young girl comes to the door. "Buongiorno. Can we help you with something?" she asks in English. Camille explains that she's new in town, trying to paint, and that Kit sent her. The assistant invites her in. She's Katie, an art student from Boston, spending an independent semester studying with Matilda and Serena. Matilda leans over her box of tints and paints, brushes and powders, selecting a brush with two or three stiff hairs, and begins to retouch the earlobe of the Madonna. She speaks in Italian, forming a circle the size of an orange with her hands. Katie translates. "I don't know how this was damaged, hard to say, but a section this big was at some time scraped by something. I'm perpetually astounded by how much survives plague and war and everything else, but just as astounded by the odd damages that occur. How? Who would do this?" Those paints, the hairdryer, looks like a Hollywood makeup artist's wares, Camille says. The women laugh. Katie shows her some works in progress, a large crucifixion punctured right in the middle, a faded landscape, not so old, a lunette of a serious man's face, and a table filled with large broken fresco pieces, like a child's jigsaw puzzle. The women are gracious, but Camille sees that she's interrupting important work. "Katie, please tell them how I am in awe of what they do. Sorry my Italian isn't up to much." "I will. They understand a lot of English from all the students they've had. Thanks for stopping by. And there are some workshops, if you're interested. We're doing a papermaking one this weekend. The bottega specializes also in illuminated manuscript repair." She gestures to a glass cabinet stacked with thick, creamy paper. "Come, it's really fun. And you go home with a beautiful packet of gorgeous pastel papers. She hands Camille a flyer. Let me check. My friends are planning a trip to Venice, but I'm not sure when we'll leave. I would love to do this. Camille unties Archie and heads back up to the piazza, where she spends an hour at Beato Angelico, furiously studying Italian pronouns. She wants to speak to Matilde and Serena. If I'm doomed to be only a Sunday painter, she thinks, maybe I could work in a different way. The waiter brings out a biscotto for Archie, a perfect distraction, since it's as hard as a bone. By late morning, Susan and Julia make their rounds in town. Wine store, fruit and vegetable stand, butcher. Julia stops at the bookstore for a Venice guidebook. Susan will say everything's online, no need for a book to lug. But Julia doesn't cozy up to electronics and prefers style and sense of place over facts. She picks up a map, too, and a copy of Jan Morris's Venice. They all meet for lunch at Stefano's, which is becoming home base, and map out a plan to travel north the following week. Chris is due back from an excursion with his group to the Maremma wine district near the coast. He will see his guests off at the Florence airport on Wednesday, and Julia says he'll join them for the Friuli excursion. She already has put in hours of research. Let's take the fast train up and spend a couple of nights in Venice first, Susan suggests. I've located a hotel right on the Grand Canal. Good. Camille can take Mathilde's papermaking workshop. She steps outside for a signal and shoots off a message to the bottega before Stefano brings the creme brulee. This is just a suggestion. I wonder if Kit would like to go with us. She speaks perfect Italian, and I think she'd be up for adventures. Oh, this is so smooth. What's the flavor I'm tasting? I think it's lavender. I'd love to have her. I think next week Colin is scheduled for London. Would she travel with us novices? Julia has a fleeting thought of Chris, but she reminds herself, this is research, business. Lucky he's used to traveling with women. After Venice, we'll rent a big car at the airport. Let's plan the Friuli part now. Susan flips open her laptop.
Are you going to eat the last bites?
Julia leans over with her spoon poised. Whatever you want to say. Colin and I spent an ideal day in Florence. We dropped our overnight bags at the hotel where we always stay. We like the old world feeling, massive leather guest books on the trestle tables in the hall, baronial chairs, blue watered silk draperies, views of domes. There are many new hotels where you could be anywhere. Here, you only could be in Italy. Running late, we took the 11 o'clock train and had lunch at a new place on the Oltrarno, the other side of the river. When we travel in Italy, afternoon is always a time for love. Gino gave us our favorite room that overlooks Piazza Tornabuoni and a slice of the Arno. Late in the day, Colin stopped by his project. As I walked in the San Lorenzo neighborhood to my favorite paper store, I rehearsed what I will say to him at dinner tonight. I can't just blurt out that our lives are forever changed. The best I come up with is to present a hypothetical. How, at this point in our lives, would you feel if we had a baby? That way we have a chance to start a conversation. Maybe I should first ask if he wants to get married. Oh, we've discussed and discussed it, and I don't know why I hold off. If we were in America, I probably would have by now. But living here and not being married just seems part of cutting ties that bind. I like the idea of being able to walk without legal consequences, even though I love Colin unconditionally. But now, if I am to have a child, I would like to want her on my own as equally as I want her with Colin. Her. Little Della. Ha! Big strapping lout of a boy. Leaf. Jamie, my father's name. Lionel, Colin's father's name. No way. Before dinner, we go up to the hotel's small bar where Gino always remembers our favorite drinks.
Not the Campari soda, the Campari only with a twist, he offers me.
Gino, grazie. For me, a ginger ale. Colin orders Campari. Then, bang. I sit there as Colin leans forward and puts his hand over my knee.
Kit, sweetheart, I have to say something, and forgive me if I'm stark crazy. You've just been a little weird. Could you be pregnant?
I snuffle a mouthful of ginger ale, and it comes spewing out my nose. Sputtering, open-mouthed, shocked, I nod. Then I begin to cry. Gino rushes over, and I wave him back, trying to smile but turning over the ginger ale in my lap. Colin slides his chair closer and puts his arm around me.
Kit, Kit, how long have you known?
Angel brains, why didn't you tell me? This is... He trails off, kissing my hair, starting to laugh. I'm hiccuping now. The two tables of other guests fix on us. We stagger out into the cold Florentine night, a swollen moon wobbling in the river. I don't know how he feels. Maybe he doesn't either. Until I calm down, we lean against the bridge wall. I erp, only a little.
Madre de Dio, Colin says.
Then we walk on silently to the trattoria we always favor, tonight displaying in the window a tangled brown octopus that sickens me again. We're settled at a table looking out at Piazza del Carmine. I'm weirdly hungry and order a plate of fried funghi porcini to start. Colin considers the wine list. For sure he can use a glass or two. He leans across the table and cups my hands in his. He twirls the sapphire set up on tiny cat's teeth that my mother left me, then takes my ring finger and rubs it.
I know a gold worker here. I would love to design something for us.
Reflexively, I say, we don't have to.
Look, you, hey, we're in this together. I know when it happened, yes?
6 weeks? 7?
We've made love since, but not like that Sunday. That memorable time together. Well, 2 times, right?
But why then?
We've had endless times like that before.
Or maybe not. Maybe I went, he lowers his voice, deeper.
Maybe you arched in a new way.
Jesu, why then? I don't want to think salmon thrusting upstream. Instead, I imagine someone pouring new green olive oil into a slim amphora. But what my body remembers is the gold rush of passion we felt together.
Okay, my kitty. He knows I hate that. Not to worry.
Seriously. All will be well because we will make it so. Back in our silk-draped bed, tender is the night. White paper. Camille and the other students follow Mathilde up a cramped staircase at the back of the bottega and into a beamed mansard room. Rows of snowy paper clipped on strings hang to dry. The windows in the sloping room end at thigh height,
and you must lean down for a view of San Rocco's roofs and bell towers. Camille looks around at the assembly of vats, wooden screw presses, neat stacks of felt in different sizes, frames, bins of cotton and linen, and long tables. All texture, monochrome, light and grain, the workroom looks like a woodcut from another century, except for the motorized pulp-grinding vat. Camille's scalp tingles. Excitement shoots through her. She felt the same in her own classes when the slides of work by Matisse, Sargent, and the Expressionists flashed by. Mathilde begins. The workshop was founded in 1710, not that long ago in Italian terms. The faintly stirring papers seem to have active life in them. Camille wants to reach up and feel the surfaces. Like the olive harvest, she later will tell Susan and Julia, you're entering rituals longer than you can imagine. It's hard to say, but you're, well, stepping into a dance long in progress, and later you'll step to the sidelines and someone takes your place. A dance seems the right metaphor as she sees the rhythm of the work, the precise steps, and where you can go too far, not far enough. As a southerner, Camille thinks she should have known about cotton linter, the tiny silky fibers that cling to the seeds in a cotton bowl after the ginning process removes large fibers. Mountains of the seeds are processed a second time to harvest these delicate filaments, which then are formed into blocks. Mathilde purchases them from a specialist in Arezzo. Serena stirs some linter into a stockpot of water, then pours this into the vat that pulverizes everything into a sloshy mess. Mathilde explains the goals of fine papermaking, and Katie, the intern, interprets for the group. Camille, an American fine press printer, an English art historian on her sabbatical, and two young Italian men who impatiently wait when the process keeps slowing for the foreigner's questions. Katie does not translate when she hears one say, "Why must they ask too many questions? Let's just get on with it." Camille knew of decalage paper, but had no idea that the term comes from the frame that determines the size of the finished sheet. She wants to ask where the word decal comes from, but since the boys look annoyed, she's trying not to interrupt. She'll read up on the history of papermaking back at the house. Vellum, she knows, thin calfskin. Parchment, isn't that more generic? Skin of goats and sheep and maybe others? Papyrus, she knows, and who doesn't from the elementary school Egypt unit. While the linter churns, Serena shows the types of paper they make and explains how to fashion a watermark from fine wires sewn onto the paper mold. They get to see repairs made on a treasured illuminated manuscript page and on a letter from Cosimo de' Medici to his son. Camille feels a visceral desire to own a stack of this thick paper. Mathilde fixes the decal over a rectangle of screen and scoops up some of the slurry mixture from the vat. Shake it to even the fibers. Smooth it out. She hands the tray to the art historian. Everyone leans in to see the goopy, drippy slush flatten out. After water oozes off, Mathilde shows Camille how to press on a piece of felt to absorb moisture, when to pull off the decal. Mathilde carefully lifts the paper onto another felt and presses again. The students take over, Mathilde and Serena guiding. During the lunch break, Camille buys a panino at the bar with Rowan Volk, the fine press printer from Berkeley. He's planning a limited edition of poems on mourning and hopes to go home with enough paper. Camille does not say that's the last thing she wants to read. He shows her a Bologna artist's border of cypress trees for his cover.
You see them at every cemetery in the Mediterranean world, he says, and I've fallen for the way they punctuate the landscape here.
He pulls books out of his bag. She admires the line drawings and the way crisp type bites into the creamy pages. She recognizes the names of only a couple of his poets, C.D. Wright, Jane Miller. How lucky they are to be immortalized in these fine books. You need to meet my neighbor, Kit Raines. She's a famous poet, too.
She lives here?
A small piece of cheese falls into his beard.
Yes, for years. She and Mathilde are good friends.
Camille made a mental note. Order Kit's books.
She gestures a flick away from her chin and smiles.
He gets it. She wants to hear more about his press. She's just understood that the paper isn't at all passive, but plays an active role in how what's printed on it is experienced. He goes first to wash his hands, then pages through the books with her. He's engrossed. She loves that. He shows her the hand-sewn folios, how the cover boards are papered, and how the finished book can be the balance point for the text. She takes out her pen and draws a lean cypress tree on her napkin.
I'm going up to Bologna tomorrow to meet my artist and to a book arts exhibit. Want to come? It's just a day trip on the train.
He cocks his head and pushes back his chair to stretch his long legs.
He's quite attractive, she notices.
That would be splendid. I'm going to Venice on Monday, but tomorrow I'm totally free. I've seen fine press exhibits, but I think I didn't understand that you're after a concept for the words, or would you say an extension for words?
Yes, both.
Camille, Venice. That's a place for paper. There's this monastery out in the lagoon that prints books in dozens of languages. You must go. Lord Byron used to study Armenian there.
He seems to know everything about paper, but never has made it himself. His eyes, black as obsidian, dart and dart, intense, tracking both of hers. They talk all the way back to the bottega. Late in the afternoon, Serena shows them how to stack the paper they've made according to size, and to squeeze each bundle under the ancient wooden press. Like handkerchiefs and scarves, they're hung to dry. Camille's favorite shape is the tall rectangle with roughly the proportions of a door. Walking home, Camille casts about for the right design of her own watermark. 3C, she thinks. Charles, Camille, Charlie. Then, no. This is for me. An arch with a keystone lettered VA for Villa Assunta? Where my work will take place. VA, Virginia, where I learned and first met artists. The toasty aroma of baking fills the kitchen. Susan and Julia are making a flat cracker.
I saw the recipe, Julia says.
They roll out a second batch, pulling the first out of the hot, hot oven.
Carta di musica, sheet music. The simplest recipe on earth. It's from the south of Italy. See, it's a flatbread as tactile and thin as old sheets of music.
This batch is flavored with rosemary, the next with fennel. It's nothing but semolina flour and water.
Look how it puffs, then settles. The Italian miracle. Something great can emerge from very little.
She breaks off a piece and hands it to Camille, who gives them both a hug.
This is just like the paper we made today. It seemed edible, too.
They gather by the fire with red wine and the savory crackers. Camille tells them about the day,
mentioning that she's going on the early train to Bologna with Rowan. Can she explain the supercharge she got from the papermaking and the conversation about art books? Let's go out for dinner. It's too late to cook. There's much to say. North to Venice.
When Julia invited me on the trip to Venice, I said yes, immediately.
I love Venice. I've loved Venice since I was 7, when my parents took me there, I told her. I was dressed in a dirndl dress from our previous stop in Austria, a little Heidi. I adored the sprigged floral pinafore over the ruffled white blouse. The first day, I left my handbag with felt cutouts on the gondola. It held coins from all the countries we visited, and my red diary, forever locked. The key on a ribbon around my neck, I was inconsolable. Daddy did his best with gelato stops, and my mother took me to a store for a new diary with nice paper. Camille may search for that shop. She's fallen in love with handmade paper. She's in Bologna today with this Rowan guy she met at the workshop. He's a fine press printer from Berkeley. Not Rowan Volk. He publishes the famous Volk editions. They're works of art, in rare book libraries everywhere. I don't know. Maybe. Anyway, they bonded. All I know is he's skinny and has a beard. She wants to ask him to dinner when we get home. Will you and Colin come? Yes, love to. You don't know how perfect an escape is for me this week. I realized that I rested my hand across my middle. I know Fitzy will be happy at Leo's. Aneta gives him scraps. Susan's bought an Archie at a farm outside town. She's worried that he doesn't speak Italian and won't understand what he's told. Oh, I know the Bruni family. They're wonderful. Archie may not want to come home. Organized Susan has made all the reservations. Oddly, though they've all been to Europe, none of the women has been to Venice. How will they react to that watery world? I go stony when someone says, it's too crowded, or Venice smells bad, or I don't like Venice. When I hear that, I think, well, I don't like you. You have to be tone-deaf and blind not to respond to the beauty of Venice. Coming up, a chance to walk over narrow bridges, look up through Gothic windows at frescoed ceilings, look over the Grand Canal at Santa Maria de la Sute's massive volumes rising out of the lagoon, look down at the colors of the palazzi swirling over the water's surface. Look, look, look. That's all I want to do. The train into Venice arrives conventionally, but that's the end of normal. Out of the teeming terminal, we enter a chaos of vaporetti disgorging passengers with too much luggage, a crush of tourists waiting to board, elegant water taxis for those who can't face the crowded ferries, and on the Grand Canal, the first sight of gondolas, those graphic black silhouettes drifting by as though in an etching of Venice. Susan has reserved a water taxi, all gleaming wood and leather. Our driver performs a fast U out of there, sending spray over the people boarding the adjacent boat. He quickly slows. If everyone hot-dogged down the canal, the combined wake would further damage the buildings. Already, and for centuries, doors are worn or boarded up at the bottom, the embarking steps long since submerged. Having made his gesture, he's in no hurry at all. We pile our carry-ons in the cabin, jackets too, since it's warm, even humid, so that we miss nothing, we move to the open stern. Leaning on top of the cabin, Julia props her chin on her hands and gazes. Susan has brought her good camera from her real estate days. She zooms in on the gardens we glimpse. You all,
This is too much, she keeps repeating. And it is. What a slideshow. Intricate facades of peach, ochre, the carmine shades, and gilt. Cupped domes against sun-splotched mottled sky. Candy-striped poles. Working barges loaded with trash, bottled water, and crates of vegetables. A long boat loaded with roof tiles lists precipitously, but one thing is for sure, Venetians know how to ply these canals. We glide by a row of particularly gorgeous palazzi throwing down their colors upon the water, and I see Camille turn away her face, her cheeks streaked with tears. They're dazzled, each with eyes wide open, mouths too. Innocence abroad, as Henry James would have it. Maybe we all become innocent when we travel. Downstream, Palladio's severe church, Il Redentore, plucked out of the air by a giant hand and placed on the quay. It's an offering to us, a building this perfect. I remember the chilling light inside, white as an icicle, every color of Venice drained off. To stand in the coldness of that light, you are purified. I will go there tomorrow. I'm a bit queasy. I duck into the cabin and take out my notebook. What words fit this place? Impossible. I jot down shimmy, glimmer, shimmer, labyrinthine, a thousand mirrors, stippling, mercurial, elegantissima, gnarls of water, spumes like angel wings, water, water everywhere. We're here. Hand it to Susan. She scored a major scoop on some last-minute app. This hotel is a palace, almost a museum. Those are Tintoretto frescoes in the Grand Hall. We're shown to a two-bedroom suite, four sumptuous beds, all draped, a living room between rooms, and a terrace smack on the Grand Canal. Enormous paintings, brocade and tassel and swag, everything. Marble baths fit for princesses. You are getting stars in your crown, I tell Susan. Colin and I usually stay at this tiny inn on a tiny canal. It's sweet, but holy madre, this is incredible. We could be visiting the Doge. Clearly, Susan, you have a killer instinct for real estate in all forms. True, I do. I can't help it. Julia waves at boats passing below. Don't ever stop, she tells Susan. This is genius. I've never stayed anywhere remotely like this. What did you tell them? Camille asks. That we are wives of sheiks? I'm floored. They've left flowers. She gestures toward a vase of pink roses on a painted chest. I've learned not to intrude with first-time visitors. If you know a place well, you tend to natter on, blocking the fresh impressions people have on their own. Susan will get them from A to B. I plan to soak in the grand tub, then take a long walk. We agree to meet on our terrace for drinks at 6. Drinks, well, little parachutist the size of my thumb, Shirley Temple with a cherry, here I come. First to San Marco, Julia instructs. She's in the lead, over bridges and down narrow calli. They step into a portico at the end of the grandiose piazza. Stunned, they see at the opposite end San Marco, looming like a fairyland caravansary in a mirage of the east. Familiar from books and movies, long arcades line the piazza, and the tilting tower anchors the whole scene to earth. They follow the strains of, could that be cherry pink and apple blossom white? Over to Florian's Cafe.
The late November sun feels warm as they arrange themselves to face the raucous facade of the basilica. Susan looks up the history on her phone. Julia reaches into her bag for her guidebook, and Camille just stares at the winged lion and the powerful prancing horses that look about to leap onto the piazza. "Our trouble must be that we come from a place with no winged lions," she observes. "Symbol of St. Mark. The place was built to house his bones. Much ado about Saint's bones back then," Susan says. Julia shows them the photo in her book of the horses.
"What we're seeing are copies, bronze. The real ones are copper. We'll find them in the museum."
The waiter brings their lunch of pasta with clams and salads.
"Their history goes way back, maybe to 2nd century Greece. Then they somehow migrated to Constantinople, where they were above the race course, the Hippodrome. The Crusaders looted them and shipped them to Venice. Big war booty."
"So not the four horsemen of the apocalypse?" Camille asked.
"No, preceded that. You dig back and almost everything Christian has a pagan explanation," Julia said. She reads on. "Listen to this. Napoleon stole them and took them to Paris. They've traveled. He installed them over the Arc de Triomphe, and after Waterloo, they somehow got home again. But in World War I, they were sent to Rome, and in World War II, they were hidden in a convent in Padova."
"I think that's going to be the story of Venice," Susan said. "Layers upon layers upon layers. All floating."
At dinner, I heard about their basilica visit. It was interesting. I haven't been inside for years because of tourist mobs, but today they breezed right in. Early winter is best. Maybe I will go tomorrow, now that they've described the circles of patterned marble floor tiles repeating the circles of gold glass tesserae on the ceiling, and the curves everywhere. "Our own architecture is quite square," Susan observed. "I wonder if Colin has noticed this, how round the internal architecture is." Camille has an especially good eye. She made these circle connections.
"We're in Venezia."
We order all four courses. Julia takes out her notebook.
"Risotto all'onda," she says. "To the wave. Perfect for my learning Italian. And perfect for Venice. A stage of cooking compared to water movement. Look at this. Black rice. You know what that's from?"
I don't say.
"Squid ink."
Susan frowns. "Wavy squid ink. Wow. Tastes better than it sounds." Next comes an orata baked in salt crust. The waiter attacks the fish with a small saw, deftly skins and bones it, lifting off flaky slices and serving them with simple boiled potatoes on each plate. Julia has ordered, just to taste, moeke, tiny male crabs of the lagoon, crunchy and succulent. Outside the window, night boats ply the black as squid ink canal. I have a few sips of the most excellent Friuli wine, so I don't call attention to my abstinence. Most pregnant Italian women I know don't give up a glass of red wine with dinner. Heaven. A hint of apple and an astringent mineral bite. Ordinarily, Colin and I split a bottle. Susan orders a second bottle and toasts travel around the table. Camille has been preoccupied all evening, but suddenly she asks, "Did you notice the entrance to the Doge's palace? That Gothic door right by San Marco? It's called Porta della Carta. Paper door. I love the name. Paper door. That resonates. Doors you can push through. Doors that are impermanent,
Doors impossible to lock. Transparent doors between two states of being. Or doors you thought were closed to you. Doors that are not doors.
Beautiful metaphor, I say. You could work with that. I could work with that.
Was such a substantial door called that? Susan asks.
When no one knows, she looks it up.
Maybe because it's near an archive. Maybe because people petitioning the council stood outside with pieces of paper.
That works too, Camille says.
Paper, she thinks. Tomorrow I will find good paper. Some for Rowan, too.
Rowan. She bites her lip. What have I done?
Susan puts down her fork. That was one fine dinner, and I am so finished. If anyone wants dessert, I might manage one bite. But back to the horses. They look alive. I was stunned that someone, some maker, back in the second, maybe third century, saw exactly as we see. I'm not even sure what I'm saying, but it's like he could walk in right now, and we could pick up a conversation we'd left off yesterday. Did you notice on the real copper horses that the artist half cut a little gash on the eyeballs so they catch the light? He wanted the glint of life on those horses. He's telling us so.
I am thrilled to hear this.
Yes, the crescent cut is called la lunula, little moon in Latin. It's on your fingernails. I hold up my forefinger to show the rising moon at the base of the nail. And someone knew to describe the cut on the horse's eyes like that. I've lived so long without knowing all these incredible things, Julia laments.
You know what you need to know, my friend. Susan takes a bite of the ginger creme brulee and slides it over to Julia.
Ginger. Write that in your book. Must be one of the spices the Venetians brought back from their saint's relic raids.
They are catching at the heartstrings of Venice quite well.
Wind comes up over the water. A wind blowing from Constantinople, across centuries, blowing a puff of dust from the races in the Hippodrome. Pulling our jackets tight, hoods up, we retrace our steps to the hotel. In our own living room, we do what women through the ages have done. We put on our robes and curl up on the sofas to talk. This is when I learn much of their pasts, and they learn some of mine. Around 2, Julia nods off, then jerks awake.
Sepioline, she says. Little cuttlefish. I like the word. Also bronzino, sea bass, orata, bream. They sound bronze and golden. Buona notte, she says. I'm fading fast.
We all head to bed. At 4, Camille feels afraid that her tossing could disturb Susan. She slips out of bed into her robe and tiptoes into the living room. She eats 2 chocolates left at turndown and pages through the hotel's fashion magazines until water reflections swirling on the ceiling draw her out to the balcony. The city is still alive. The wind has blown elsewhere, and it seems that the stars jangle, but it's only metal clanging in the moorings of boats along the quay. What was the word she'd just read in one of the magazines? Gibigiana? She says it out loud. The flashes of reflected light on water. How evocative. Rowan would like that word. Rowan. Charles gone 18 months, and she's saying Rowan. Well, that's the least of it, after yesterday. Sex was the last thing on my mind, she thinks. Since Charles died, sex is the subject I shove aside. That's over. And I'm old, so that's okay. I had my share and more. All those years of freedom and easy connection with love and fire. She tries to